Well, music can bring people together, and it can push them apart. Sarah Val learned this as a teenager growing up in Montana, where she was in marching band, band one, symphony band, jazz band, pep band, orchestra, and the Bozeman Recorder Ensemble. She told the story at a broadcast that This American Life did in front of a live audience in San Francisco.
It was autumn in America, a fine, hot Indian summer day. Pretty high school girls sat on bleachers with the sun shining on their pretty hair, watching handsome high school boys play football. And then it was halftime, which is where I came in. I was standing in line in my silver spats down past the end zone waiting to go on. I was in 11th grade. I was in marching band. I had a foot-tall, fake-fur, black hat with the vaguely processed food name Shaco strapped under my chin. That not only prevented me from breathing, it prevented me from balancing, so that even though my job was to march around as some kind of sick metaphor for teenage military precision, I moved through time and space with the grace and confidence of a puppy walking on a beach ball. Because of my double shortage of strength and coordination, I barely passed gym, but somehow I was supposed to lift a baritone horn that measured twice my body weight, blow into it while reading microscopic sheet music, step in a straight line while remembering left foot on beats one and three, right foot on beats two and four, and maneuver myself into cute visual formations like the trio of stick figures when we played the theme from My Three Sons. And then, halfway through the halftime program, I had to break formation, drop my baritone horn on the field, and sprint to the 50-yard line, a long haul, with everyone in the band, everyone in the bleachers, everyone on the sidelines, watching and waiting, silent and still. And then I picked up my mallets. This is what they had been waiting for, a xylophone solo on a little Latin-flavored number called Tico Tico. My polo shirt-clad nemesis, Andy Heap, stood up in the stand screaming, "Val! Val! Woo! Woo!" as the laughter of his friends at me drowned out the horn section. This was the same Andy Heap, I might add, who earlier in the week in music history class had delivered an oral report on Tchaikovsky's mistress and referred to her as Mimi throughout, even though her name was Nadia. Andy Heap was apparently smart enough to publicly humiliate me during Tico Tico. He just wasn't smart enough to know that the abbreviation MME period stands not for Mimi, but the title Madame. Anyway, I only had a second to stick out my tongue at Andy when I finished because I had to let go of the mallets, rush over to my baritone, again the freeze frame spectators, the loneliness of the long distance runner, and I'm back in formation with the low brass for the finale. And I was getting academic credit for this. I was getting graded, which begs the question, what exactly was I supposed to be learning? Marching is not a particularly applicable skill in later life. And ditto all the other handy things music classes taught me. The E-flat minor scale, the alternate fingering for D-sharp. Here then, some of the lessons, actually useful ones, I accidentally learned while pursuing music. Accidental lesson number one, Marxism for 10th graders. Once a week, the best band kids played with the orchestra. I played the bass drum in orchestra, which meant that I never got to play. My participation ratio was something like 75 measures of rest per one big bass wallop, which gave me plenty of time to contemplate the class warfare of the situation. And here's what I figured out. Orchestra kids wore tuxedos. Band kids wore tuxedo t-shirts. And the orchestra kids with their brown woolens and Teutonic last names had the well-scrubbed dark blonde aura of a Hitler youth brigade. These were the sons and daughters of humanities professors. They took German. They actually played soccer. Dumping the fluorescent t-shirts of the band kids into the orchestra each week must have looked like tossing a handful of Skittles into a bowl of Swiss chocolates. But nothing brings kids together like hate. And the one thing the band kids and the orchestra kids had in common was a unified disgust for the chorus kids, who were to us merely drama geeks with access to four-part harmony. A shy violin player wasn't likely to haunt the halls between classes playing Eine kleine Nachtmusik any more than a band kid would blare Land of a Thousand Dances on his tuba more than 3 inches outside the band room door. But that didn't stop the choir girls from making everyone temporarily forget their locker combinations thanks to an impromptu, uncalled-for burst of Brigadoon. Andy Heap, chorus. Accidental discovery number 2. Where's Walter? My junior high had an electronic music lab. We made tape loops and learned words like quadrophonic. In my spare time, you know, just for fun, I checked out all the books on electronic music from the library. My favorite records for a while there were Walter Carlos's concept album Switched on Bach and its sequel, The Well-Tempered Synthesizer, which offered what I thought were hilariously witty covers of Bach classics performed on, get this, a Moog synthesizer. But in my readings on electronic music, something puzzled me. Every time I'd look into Walter Carlos, the information would just stop and someone named Wendy Carlos would turn up. I got to school early one morning to ask my electronic music teacher what happened to Walter and was Wendy Walter's wife or daughter, and my teacher kind of didn't answer for a long time, and then he blurted out, Wendy is Walter. What did he mean? Walter had a sex change operation and changed his name to Wendy. What's a sex change operation? Now, I know it's hard to capture now, here in San Francisco. What a shock this was. I knew absolutely nothing about sex. We didn't talk about sex in my house, and sex ed wasn't scheduled until spring. That Walter Carlos, I hadn't even recovered from the shock that Bach could be messed with. Number 3, biology as destiny. In 7th grade, I started band. I wanted to play the drums. My parents, who lived with me, as was the custom in Montana, did not want me to play the drums. So I picked the next loudest instrument, the trumpet. How I loved my trumpet, the feel of it in my hands, its very volume and shine. You know what I especially loved? The spit valve. In 8th grade, a teacher told me about this good old trumpet player I might like, so I went out and bought one of his records. And every night, for over a year, I went to sleep listening to it, the same songs over and over, trying to figure out why Louis Armstrong was so funny, so moving, so good. And I got caught up in this superstar talent of his right around the time I was beginning to suspect that I didn't have it. Talent, I mean. And there was another problem, too, which I discovered about 3 years into my trumpet career. I found out the reason I was getting a shoddy tone and I had trouble hitting the high notes was because of the shape of my jaw. The shape of my jaw. I felt the world was more or less over. I was outraged that a person's fate could depend on something as arbitrary as the angles of her teeth. And not only that, I had to switch to a brass instrument with a bigger mouthpiece, the baritone horn. The baritone horn, like trumpets are played by Miles Davis and baritones are played by nobody. Lesson number 4, when doves cry. From the time I was 12 until I finished high school at 18, my poor parents' calendar was blackened by an ambitious roster of concerts and recitals averaging at least one per month. They were always so gushy in their support, it never dawned on me that they might have preferred to avoid junior high school gymnasium performances of the theme from Rocky. They acted as though their world revolved around my sister and me, and that's what we believed. But I remember one night after an eighth grade band concert, I caught a glimpse of pencil marks on my father's rolled up program. He told me that he checked each movement of each piece off as they ended. Obviously, because he was counting the seconds until he could go home. At the time, I took it badly. I was offended that he had so little regard for the seriousness of our interpretation of what do you do with a drunken sailor. But now I see those pathetic little check marks as heart-shaped symbols of his love. Everyone says that love requires the utmost honesty, but that's not entirely true. Once I knew that my father was suffering for my sake, really suffering, I learned that love, especially the parental kind, requires the heartwarming sacrifice that can only accompany fake enthusiasm. Number 5, birth of cool. So, I was doomed at the trumpet, acceptable at the baritone, shaky on the xylophone, and putrid on the piano. But there was one instrument for which I had an innate knack, an instrument I could play with some semblance of grace. It was, unfortunately, an instrument which was already on its way out during the lifetime of J.S. Bach, the recorder. I taught myself to play it when I was 11, and by 14, I was perhaps the youngest member of the American Recorder Society, reading their journal, The American Recorder, and practicing the Elizabethan and Baroque music I special ordered with my babysitting money. I found out about an amateur ensemble that met once a week in my town, playing mostly Elizabethan standards like It Was a Lover and His Lass, at a tempo marked on the metronome as post office slow. The members of the Bozeman Recorder Ensemble, as we were called, included a retired high school music teacher, two math professors, and a number of housewives, one of whom had a daughter in my grade. I was the only member under the age of 40, and most of them would have been eligible for the senior citizen discount at the music store. I played with them for a couple of years, until my pals Margaret and Leota and I broke off to form our own trio. The three of us just plain liked each other, liked playing. At school, in all those hours of actual classes with actual teachers, music felt more like a job. Playing with Leota and Margaret was the first time, the only time, I actually enjoyed playing music. And here's a little Elizabethan song we used to do called Willow Willow, which is, this is actually my first public performance since the Reagan administration. Which I was kind of looking forward to, and on my way here, I was walking down Market, and there was this guy on the street playing the recorder, and I kind of got a glimpse of what that looks like. I'm a little less sure. So this is Willow Willow from a manuscript in the British Museum. Playing that on the street with your two friends who happen to be older than your parents, and you look up from your music stand and notice one of your schoolmates staring on in horror. Andy Heap, for instance. But you know what? You don't care. You might even smile at him. And this is the most important lesson of marching band, of public displays, of recorder. To withstand embarrassment. Maybe even seek it out. To take nerdiness to its most dizzying willow, willow, tico, tico extremes. And stand before my peers with my head held high. To stick out my tongue at the Andy Heaps of the world, run back to the baritone horn of life, and blow mighty and proud.